I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The University of Missouri-Kansas City has long been dubbed a commuter school. As such, it not only faces the challenges all higher education institutions face, it has some work to do in building school spirit as well. Today, we sit down with Chancellor Agarwal. In his first few months on the job, he's begun addressing the future direction of the university, and he's determined to create a culture of belonging. Then, after a contentious confirmation process, Brett Kavanaugh has made it to the highest court in the land, but the tension is likely far from over. We'll discuss the increasing use of the court as a political tool and see what's in store now that it has a solid conservative majority. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In the months since Molly Agarwal was named Chancellor of the University of Missouri-Kansas City, he's launched an array of initiatives aimed at boosting research, altering the focus of the school's urban education mission, and rethinking the location of the new music conservatory. One other emphasis, injecting a greater sense of school spirit into a campus heavily populated with commuter students. It's been a crash course in the critical role that UMKC plays in the life of Kansas City. Molly Agarwal comes to Kansas City after a stint as the interim provost and vice president for academic affairs at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He's also worked as a professor of orthopedics and bioengineering at the University of Texas Health Science Center. This is his first visit to Up to Date, and Chancellor, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And just a reminder, I'm on the faculty at UMKC, and the university holds the license for this radio station. Just guessing here, Chancellor, you haven't had a lot of downtime the past few months. Am I right?
It has been busy, but it has been wonderful. The transition to Kansas City has just been very, very easy. It's a very easy city to move to. The people are very, very friendly. We are discovering what Midwest nice means, and the city is easy to move about in, and UMKC is a great place. So it's been just a wonderful transition.
Why did you take this job now here in Kansas City? What was the draw for you?
That's a really good question. So we had been in San Antonio for 27 years, and over that period of time, you do set down roots, and we had set down roots. Our kids were born there, had grown up there. Mm-hmm. And we were not looking to move, but I did get a call one day by a very good friend and mentor of mine who Kansas City knows well because he used to be the chancellor here a while ago at UMKC, Dr. Guy Bailey.
Sure.
And he said, I think UMKC may call you, and I think you should listen to what they're saying because this may be an opportunity you look at. And when UMKC did call, I did do my due diligence. I looked at UMKC and looked at all the facets that they have, from a world-class music conservatory, performing arts, to the health sciences district, and engineering and business and education, all the elements that are so rare to find on one campus nowadays. And then I looked at Kansas City and all that is going on here, and there's a lot going on. It's in the top 10 list for many, many things now.
Right.
Put those two together, and I was convinced something wonderful is going to happen. And so my wife, Sue, and I decided that we wanted to be here when that happens.
And here you are.
And they, here we are.
Now let's turn to some of your initiatives, Chancellor. You want to grow enrollment and you want to increase retention. David Steelman, the head of the Board of Curators for the University of Missouri, was just on this show, and he said that UMKC needs to grow by as many as 5,000 students to reach what he considers would be its optimum size. Is that your goal, too?
Our goal may be perhaps a little bit more aggressive than that.
Hmm.
We would like to grow about 50% in size.
50%?
50% over the next 10 years.
So taking a campus of 16,400 roughly?
To about 24,000.
Wow.
And I'll tell you why. When you look at UMKC and where we are located and look at the MSA, the metro area, we're a metro area of about 2 million to 2.2 million. And if you look at the enrollment for UMKC, we count about 3,000 dual credit students in that enrollment. So if you keep those aside, we're a campus of 13,000 to 14,000 students. That's a campus too small to serve a community of 2 million people. That means, and being the only public research university in this area, that means we are asking young folks to go elsewhere to get the education. And if they go elsewhere, it's likely that they will stay elsewhere. And not everyone has the wherewithal or the financial capacity or the family situation to go elsewhere. So we want to make sure that we provide opportunities for all our young folks right here in Kansas City.
How do you grow a campus by 50% over the next few years?
Well, we need to do a good job bringing the story of UMKC out, of how great a place it is. We are also working closely with our community here and our friends of the university to get more scholarships in place. And we have to do it very carefully. As we grow, we also have to grow the infrastructure around it within the university, more faculty, more staff, better buildings, better facilities. But it can be done. And we feel like it's our role to do this here in this community, because ultimately we exist to serve our community.
And maybe hand in hand with that idea, you also want to improve the student experience. What do you have in mind there?
Yes, the student experience is a very big part of the overall college experience. In my first meeting here with the students, even before I officially started, they told me that they wanted me to build a full campus experience for them, and we should have less of a flavor of being a commuter school. That means more residential, more programming on campus till late at night, fun things like athletics going on, other kinds of programming going on campus, more eating places, just all the things that we all remember from our college days outside of the classroom. And we have to put those on or close to campus so the students can have that full campus experience.
You've already announced that the men's basketball team will be playing some of its games on campus at Swinney Recreation Center. They play now downtown at Municipal Auditorium. So that's one big change.
That is, and that's because the students that are residing next to campus can then walk over to the games, and that will make it much easier for them to share in that excitement of the games there.
So you're talking about a transformation of this campus over the next 5 to 10 years, a big transformation.
That is correct, because we feel that Kansas City is poised and already starting on a big transformation. I think Kansas City will be one of the big stories of the 21st century. And I think every great city is anchored by a great university. And it is our role to step in and play that.
You know, one of the challenges that the campus has faced in recent years is this idea of what is the place? Is there a place for Division I athletics? You know, a lot of my students say that they could care less about sports. They'd rather have lower tuition. What is the place of Division I men's basketball, the other sports? Why is there a place for that? Because clearly you're doubling down there.
Well, we have been Division I. We have done well in Division I. We have won various conference championships over the past few years. And there's an excitement to Division I that comes and it contributes to the campus experience. The other piece we need to look at, who are our peers academically and who are our aspirational peers academically? And they are all Division I. So not only do we want to compare ourselves with them academically, but we also want to play them in sports.
And so, beat them too, right?
And beat them. Well, our team's already beating some of the Power Five institutions. So they are doing really well. Our student athletes are at UMKC are students first and athletes second, and they actually live up to that. The average GPA for our student athletes is about 3.25. Hmm. And for pockets of those, like the women's soccer team, which just got ranked in the Western region in the top, the number 9, with Stanford being number 1, their average GPA is 3.75. Hmm. So these young men and women are performing on the field, but also in the classroom.
UMKC's new Chancellor Molly Agrawal joins me here this morning on Up to Date. You also want to grow research, and you were known for having some success at doing just that down in Texas. What are you talking about there? What do you want to do?
It's been shown that the more research a university does and the more investment in research, the better the community does. And this has been shown at the city level. It's been shown at the state level. The states that invest more in research in the universities also end up doing better economically. Our research numbers could grow. We are doing some good research. We have some fantastic faculty, but there's scope to do much more. And we have some great assets in place already. The Health Sciences District, we have 4 health pieces, the medical school, the dental school, the pharmacy, nursing. They are all located together. They're located in the midst of these other hospitals that we collaborate with. That gives us a great opportunity to do more research on the health side, on the health outcome side. But we also have great work going on in biological sciences and engineering in the defense area. And I think tying them all together is data science, big data. And so we will be looking to grow in that area. It will can also service, from the workforce point of view and perhaps from the research point of view, several industries that already exist in the Kansas City area, such as Cerner and Garmin and mm-hmm. HR and Block. And if you want to consider IRS, they all are groups that deal with large amounts of data.
Let's turn to some of the other issues on campus, some of which predated your arrival here, Chancellor. You decided to regroup and shift course on a new music conservatory. You want this new building to be closer to the main Volcker campus. The original plan was to build it downtown by the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Why the change?
First of all, what a great program. As I've got to talk to the students and to the faculty, I've just been amazed at the level of excellence that we have here. This is a unique gem, not just at UMKC, but for all of Kansas City and perhaps for the whole country. And so we need to do the right thing for them in terms of what's the best thing we need to do for them as an academic program, what's best for our students and for our faculty. And as this whole process has evolved and we have talked to the faculty and staff and students, it has become clear that what would be best in their interest, the interest of the students, would be to have it closer, the new building closer to the Volcker campus, because the students do take courses on campus. Their gen ed courses are here.
Right.
And it becomes a problem for them to then travel to any other place. So if you can locate it as close to campus or on campus, that would be the best for the program and for the students.
Obviously, the original idea was to build this downtown by the Kauffman Center, as I just mentioned. One of the prime benefactors of this new facility, Julia Irene Kauffman, has long ago withdrawn her $20 million pledge. How do you make up for that loss, and what's the current price tag of what you want to do here?
We have not got down to that level of the actual price tag, although if I had to take a guess, I would say it would be about the same what it was last time. I
think most, $100 million.
About $100 million. Mm-hmm. I realized last time around, the legislature was very supportive of it, and there was some money that was going to come from the state that hit a snag at the very last minute, and that was unfortunate. However, friends and donors, I think, have provided steadfast support for the idea of doing the right thing for the program, and I think they will continue to provide that support as this whole process evolves and it becomes more clear what is needed and exactly where this thing will be built.
You know, Chancellor, the new governor, Mike Parson, has expressed more support for this kind of idea. Do you plan to go back to the legislature in the 2019 session and ask for state support again?
We will need all kinds of support. We'll have to cobble the support together all over again, and we will go to our donors, to the governor, to the legislature, to the system. We will be looking for support all across because, as I said, this is such a wonderful program, and it deserves a new building.
Again, UMKC Chancellor Mali Agrawal is my guest. The General Assembly cut higher education spending by 6% a year ago. They lawmakers restored much of it this past year. How convinced are you that this state is truly behind higher education in a meaningful way here?
I think just listening, and again, being new to the state, just listening to the governor, I'm convinced that his heart is in the right place as far as higher education is concerned, and that there will be continued support for higher education as we go along. Having said that, times are tough for higher education all across the country, and we have to be more efficient, and we have to do more with what we have in place without putting an undue burden on the backs of our students through higher educational costs.
You know, as somebody who has covered lawmakers in both our states for many years, you know, it seems to me that the reputation, the image of higher education has taken a real kick in the pants over the last, 15, 20 years. What needs to happen to improve the image of higher education before important folks like Missouri and Kansas state lawmakers?
I think one of the things we have to do is talk more about the benefits of higher education and how higher education is now becoming a necessity and imperative rather than just a luxury. If you look at the fact that we're in a global market now, that for each job we compete globally, young folks will be competing with folks from across the world for each job, and that most of the jobs in the future will require post-high school education. Higher education becomes very, very important. And the states that will invest more and will have more educated workforce will be the ones that will prosper, and the same thing will be true for the countries. And now we have some tough competition from around the world.
The new governor, again, Mike Parson, is a Republican, and he seems to understand that pretty clearly. He speaks some of the same language that you just offered here.
I think so. I've heard him a couple of places, and he's talked a lot about workforce development, and he's talked about, I've read some of his comments about higher education, and I think he fully understands what needs to be done.
You know, different issue here, Chancellor. UMKC is ending its sponsorship of 8 Kansas City charter schools. This was just in the news in recent days. Why is the school making that change?
We have looked at what we have and what are we best at, and we are best at doing research and providing best practices and helping students in students and the schools in that fashion. We didn't think our time would be best used if we were doing the sponsorships and taking charge of how the schools were being run. We'll continue to fully engage with the schools, but engage on fronts that we are really good at.
What does this mean for the future of those particular charter schools that UMKC has sponsored for so many years?
I don't think it will make any difference to them because they're already talking to other sponsors, and we are also in the process of helping them find other sponsors. So it's just trying to find the right way to support the schools in the ways, in the things that we know best.
You know, some current and former UMKC students have been the subject of violence in the metro in recent years. What impact has that had on the enrollment of international students who are especially valuable to universities because they pay full price to go to a school like UMKC? What are you seeing on that front?
We haven't seen a decrease yet, but I share that concern. What happened earlier in the year, that was in my second or third week as chancellor, was very, very unfortunate. But violent street crime happens in every big city, and Kansas City is no different in that respect. All of us have to be a little aware and wise about where we go. And I think UMKC is a very safe place to come to school to. Crime on campus is very, very low. And we do have to fight any perception to the contrary.
Has that resulted in a tamping down of the enrollment of international students here on our campus?
At this point, we haven't seen any differences. Just because what happened last year was pretty much after the enrollment had people had already committed, and we're not sure what will happen this coming year. But we have been talking to a lot of our international students for them to then go talk to their fellow countrymen and countrywomen, and tell them that this is a safe place and Kansas City is a safe place and Missouri is a safe place for international folks.
You know, Chancellor, as I talk to my students in classrooms week after week, one of the big concerns that tends to come up is their concern over affordable housing. Prices around UMKC are going up. We've had some struggles with construction defects in some of the dormitories. We're sort of going through a mini crisis here of sorts. What's on your agenda in terms of affordable housing?
Affordable housing is very much on my plate. For taking care of some of the setbacks we have had recently, but also in the long term, when we mentioned that we will increase enrollment by about 50%, that means there's a lot more students coming. The rule of thumb for public urban research universities is about 20% of your student population should reside on campus or next to campus. We are not at that level yet at UMKC. And then on top of that, if we increase enrollment, that number will go up. So we'll have to look at different ways to get affordable housing developed on campus or close to campus. We are very excited, on one hand, about the streetcar coming down to UMKC. It will be wonderful for us to be connected. On the other hand, we also realize realistically that with that coming, property values will go up and rents will go up. And so we realized that, and I have a task force set up to start looking at student residential issues. Also goes back to where we were discussing a full campus experience.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things point toward more student housing on or close to campus. How we get there, we still have to figure that out.
I gather that suggests that it's likely that UMKC might be in the business of building more dormitory buildings in the years to come?
Either we build on a campus or we partner and do public-private partnerships. But in one way or the other, we need to have affordable student housing in the vicinity of UMKC.
Now, you also have mentioned the need to refurbish a fabulous old home on campus. I'm talking about the Epperson House. You know, students, particularly at this time of the year, and many members of the faculty, as you know, believe the home is haunted. It's been empty for a number of years. First, I'm wondering, is it haunted? And why do you want to spend significant dollars to get it back in shape?
About the haunted part, I have no indication. I did get to go visit it, and it's just as gorgeous on the inside as it is on the outside. It is a true treasure.
Spectacular house.
It is a spectacular house. I had threatened folks that I'll move in there if you don't do anything with it. We need to restore it. We need to give it some good use. As I said, it's a jewel for UMKC, for Kansas City. And currently, it's just boarded up and not getting any better.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be put to use. There are many options. I have another task force looking at that. Some things that come to mind, a faculty center, an alumni center, a conference center.
Sure.
It will take some money, and I most probably will have to reach out to the community and friends of UMKC who may be able to provide those resources to get it refurbished. A big piece of that will be bringing it up to ADA code, because it is an old house, and those changes will have to be made.
So donors in the Kansas City area, be forewarned, you're going to become asking for significant donations to further the work of UMKC in the years and months to come.
That is for sure, because we have high aspirations. We have ways to go. We are a very good university, but we would like to be a great university in a great city. And that will require everyone doing their piece, and that includes the community. Will have to step up and help us get there.
Chancellor, 5 years from now, how will we be able to measure whether the reign of Mali Agrawal has been successful or not? What are some of the benchmarks you would put out there?
First of all, I would take exception to the word reign.
Okay.
Because I think it's a joint effort, and I just happen to be the person at the front.
Fair enough.
But it will be the team. We have, as I said, in our strategic plan, we have put out clear metrics and clear targets, and everything will be measurable. And so hold us accountable, look at those metrics and those targets, and they are on a variety of issues, but we have made it clear that everything will be measured to make sure that we're moving, and there's only one direction to move, and that's up. Not because we're bad, but from now on, we will never move backward. We'll always move forward.
That's UMKC's new Chancellor, Mali Agrawal. Chancellor, a pleasure to have you here. Good luck with your work. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the future of the U.S. Supreme Court in the wake of Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, I had the pleasure of speaking with jazz genius and MacArthur Fellow, Harvard Professor Vijay Iyer. You can listen to that and other episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we're taking the show on the road to Washington, D.C. We'll be broadcasting live from the NPR mothership for a conversation with Missouri's U.S. Senator Roy Blunt and national political correspondent Mara Liasson. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has been thrust into the spotlight, if you haven't caught it lately in a way we haven't seen in a while. How long it'll remain there is up for debate. Democrats point to the rebuff Merrick Garland. Republicans might harken back to the nomination of Robert Bork back in 1987. Here to help us consider the past and especially the future of the Supreme Court is Frank Colucci. He's an associate professor of political science at Purdue University Northwest and author of Justice Kennedy's Jurisprudence, The Full and Necessary Meaning of Liberty. Frank will be discussing this very issue this evening at the Kansas City Public Library's Central Branch at 10th and Baltimore. For more information, go to kclibrary.org. Frank, it's a pleasure. Welcome.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks.
Let's just jump right into the deep end, Frank. Has the country ever seen such a bitter, partisan confirmation process for a Supreme Court justice as we just witnessed with Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, actually, I think we've seen a couple in the last 30 years, which have kind of, in many ways, kind of led to this moment. Thinking back 1992 to Clarence Thomas's hearings and the controversy both before and after Anita Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And even thinking back before that, a few years to 1987 and the Robert Bork nomination of the Supreme Court and his eventual rejection by the U.S. Senate. So we have in maybe it's a generation ago,
mm-hmm.
have seen something like this. And in many ways, both those battles, and especially the Bork battle, really bring us to where we are now, because it was only after the Senate defeated Robert Bork's nomination that eventually led to the process of Anthony Kennedy being nominated and then confirmed to the Supreme Court in 1987, and he took a seat in January of 1988.
Anthony Kennedy obviously turned out to be a pivotal member of that court, perhaps the pivotal member of the court, right?
Yeah, over the last 30 years, many ways, both he and Sandra Day O'Connor, when she was on the court until 2005, but certainly over the last 12 to 13 years, that Kennedy has been a decisive vote in many critical cases, and in many critical cases decided by a 5-4 vote in a variety of issues ranging from abortion to gay rights to executive power to federal-state relations to cases involving the death penalty and campaign finance and many other issues, that Kennedy has been the pivotal vote in just about all these areas.
You know, Republican legislators claim the partisanship shown in Kavanaugh's confirmation was, you know, this unprecedented deal. And Democrats are saying, hey, what about Merrick Garland? Who's right here? And who should we blame for the partisan nature of today's Supreme Court confirmations? Or is there enough blame to go around to everybody here?
You know, I think everyone is taking the situation a step up from the previous person. But I do think the Merrick Garland non-hearings actually are a difference. I think it's one thing to have an open vote, even to reject someone, and a second to make a decision not to have a vote on someone, not because of that candidate, anything against that candidate. In fact, most Republicans have very great things to say about Merrick Garland himself, but the fact that you want to keep that seat open for an election so that your party can fill it.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a bit of a qualitative difference. I mean, we could go back before about partisanship. And although we do talk about Bork and Thomas, the second change is this. In Bork and Thomas, you had, for both nominations, many senators from both parties voting both ways. We have a much more party polarization on judicial nomination process, even for lower federal judicial nominees and for the Supreme Court now that we've had. Then part of that may be an effect of the parties becoming much more ideologically pure or identifiable themselves, and also judicial nominations becoming much more important.
We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and the future of the court in the wake of a Kavanaugh confirmation. If you have questions about this topic or for Frank Colucci, we want to hear them. You can give us a call at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's talk about some specific examples here, Frank. Justice Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings were very bitter and for similar reasons having to do with sexual harassment allegations from Anita Hill. Did that bitterness affect the kind of justice he ultimately became, in your view?
My answer to that is no. People will disagree. But I think that Thomas had a pretty defined idea of what he thought the law would be beforehand. And it's one that differs even predominantly from many other conservative justices on the court.
In what way?
That he would take a much more, even for an originalist, he would take a much more originalist approach on issues such as the extended federal power and preserving state powers. I don't think his jurisprudential decisions can be traceable to bitterness from the hearings. How it has affected him in his other ways. It may have something to do with his reticence to asking questions on the bench.
But yeah. Well, maybe what I'm trying to get at is why is a bitter confirmation process dangerous? I mean, shouldn't we be ruthless with these Supreme Court vettings? Because, you know, we are talking about a lifetime appointment here, after all.
Okay. I actually think that there is some value to a very rigorous confirmation process of getting as much information as you can about someone's past records. Both as a judge and maybe even before as a judge, became a judge, but to get some information about them.
The justices don't say anything. The nominees don't say anything any longer. Right. There's this game, this pattern that's been established where the American people don't really find out much of anything.
I think that's true. I mean, when I say the confirmation process should be more rigorous, I don't necessarily mean about the tenor of the questions asked to the nominee. I would want much more of a focus on that person's record, either their previous judicial record or their previous record in either government service or in any other occupation that they've had in their life that could be relevant to their views about the law and their views about the proper role of courts.
As opposed to where they're going in the future, which they're hesitant to talk about anyway, right?
Right. One thing is, when you're nomination proceedings are very well coached. Right. So what you're really focusing on are not necessarily the answers from the nominee, but the information you can get from the nominee's past.
Yeah.
Taking from that view, the major issue from the Kavanaugh hearings would be the lack of information, certainly about his records and his time working the Senate and in the Bush administration. That would be much more trouble. Getting that information would probably be much more illuminating to senators making their decisions than any answers that he may or may not have given himself. But to have that information about someone's view of the law and view of legal issues is significant.
If you'll slip on those headphones, we got a caller here. I'm going to take one here. And if anyone else wants to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Frank from Lawrence, welcome.
Thanks. Professor, my question has to do with two items commentators are using lately about the Supreme Court here in the United States. One of them would be putting term limits on the justices, like 16 years for each justice. And the second one has to do with other countries in Europe, especially, that have many more people on their Supreme Courts, more than just nine, up into like 10 and 15 people on the Supreme Courts of those other countries. What do you think about that? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great question, Frank. Let's start with the term limits. Why do we have lifetime appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court? Why not limit them?
Okay. The justification for life tenure actually comes back to the Federalist Papers in Federalist 78, where Alexander Hamilton writes that if you want someone to be a good judge, someone who is a partisan of the Constitution, to focus their decisions only on law, you need to attract the best people. And the only way you're going to get these best people is if you want judges who will conduct their very difficult job effectively. Because as we know, judges, they issue decisions. They can't enforce them. They actually rely on persuasion of the other political branches to fulfill their decisions. So if you want to have strong judges who will uphold the Constitution, even though they're institutionally weaker, right? Courts are Article III, and they can be overrun by Article I, Congress, and Article II, the presidency.
So this is Alexander Hamilton's
legacy.
Yeah,
so the reason we
here.
Need a strong judicial branch, and the only way you're going to get people who have the qualities of knowledge of the law and integrity, including independence, is to attract them with life tenure. If you only had certain terms, or if they were to be either reappointed by the president or reconfirmed by the Senate, the worry is that they would bend their decisions to favor a president or favor a Senate to keep their own job. Hamilton's argument was that we really don't have as many people as we need to that we have to make this job as attractive as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that having a judicial system which didn't have which all the people in there were seen as politically pliable or liable to the president who nominated them or to the Senate who confirmed them. They would look to those political considerations rather than to the Constitution.
But a 15-year appointment is a pretty lengthy appointment.
Right. There's actually a good website called Fix the Court, and a group called Fix the Court, which advocates for 18-year term limits. If we have 9 Supreme Court justices, you serve for 18 years, and you know there'll be an opening every 2 years, so you know there'll be 2 over every presidential term. And that would maybe some would say that would balance things out. The second consideration that they make is that you'll have judges who there will be less of an incentive to appoint a judge who's in their late 40s or early 50s, mm-hmm. that you might appoint someone who might have a bit more experience in the law and experience as a judge. So the argument for term limits is that life tenure may not be as beneficial as Hamilton saw it at the time.
The other part of the question was, why do we have 9 justices, why not 15 like some European nations do?
And the simple answer to that is Congress could change that anytime it wants. Mm-hmm. If the House and Senate pass a law and the president signs a law to increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court, they can. And we've done that in the past, right? The Supreme Court was initially 6 justices and then has increased and decreased over time. It was up to even 10 for a short period of time. During and after the Civil War. But Congress can pass a law. Article 1, Congress has the power to make rules about the judicial system, including what the federal courts will look like and how many justices will be on the Supreme Court.
So is there an advantage to having more justices?
One advantage of having more justices would be that it would be much less likely that one single justice would be a deciding vote, right? And one single justice would be a deciding vote all the time. Now, the issue is, how do you get from here to there? If you increase the number of justices, doesn't that imply that the president who is president at that time will be able to appoint all those justices? Mm-hmm. And the Senate, who was the Senate at the time, will be able to confirm all those justices. So that would be a way – there would at least be an initial advantage, political advantage, to whatever party increases the number of the courts. And that's something that's at least potentially brought up by, if not Democratic politicians, at least some Democratic activists, that as a result of the last couple of Supreme Court seats, Garland not getting a hearing and Kavanaugh getting on, that one of the Democrats' priorities perhaps in if they were to get both the presidency and the House and the Senate after 2020 would be to perhaps increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court by 2.
The future of the U.S. Supreme Court is our topic. 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Frank Colucci, again, will be speaking on the future of the court 6:30 this evening at the Kansas City Public Library's central location. More information, kclibrary.org. Let's go to Ben from Overland Park. Ben, you're on up to date.
Hello there. I think one point that I have not heard yet made, and I think needs to be understood, is I've heard a lot of people on the left, Democrats, say that this has become an overly politicized process and that it's unfairly politicized. And coming from it from a conservative point of view, as myself, I think conservatives have seen this as a politicized process for 30 to 40 years, frankly, and have been setting up institutions and playing the long game to try to get Supreme Court justices that are conservative into the pipeline. And, it's one of these things where, I think conservatives have seen this as the Supreme Court specifically around some landmark rulings in the 70s as a politicized entity a generation ago. And if Democrats are just coming to that, then they're a little late.
Do you buy that premise that Republicans have been building towards this for quite some time?
Oh, absolutely. And there's actually been a couple of great other books in political science scholarship that have really tracked the intentional changes in the judiciary, particularly through the Federalist Society. There's a great book by Professor Stephen Telish called The Rise of the Conservative Legal Establishment, and a very good book by Amanda Hollis-Bruski called Ideas with Consequences, looking specifically at the Federalist Society. That this has been this has certainly been a deliberate process on the conservative side and even within the Republican Party sort of over the last 40 years. And you can see it even at the introduction of Kavanaugh, when Trump introduced him at the nomination, one of the persons who was there was Leonard Leo, who was the president of the Federal Society and has been kind of been working through all these judicial nominations on the Republican side, certainly over the last 30 years or so. So it's actually a little bit of a difference on the political science side, maybe a little bit different than lawyers look at the Supreme Court. That political scientists have been much more likely to see the political ramifications, political decisions about nominees, courts, decisions and court nominations having political motivations and political consequences. And that implies not just decisions by presidents about nominations, but also decisions by the Senate about who to confirm.
Mm-hmm.
And that Republicans and conservatives have often used the Supreme Court and Supreme Court nominations and even opposition to particular decisions like, say, Roe versus Wade as a motivating factor to get people to vote. And I think for the first time Saturday in his closing statement, Charles Schumer, the minority leader Democrat from New York, finally made that statement. It's almost conceding defeat here, but if you want a different type of Supreme Court, he says, you have to go out and vote. Republicans have known that for 40 years.
Speaking of the Senate and the confirmation process, Mark from Valley Falls, Kansas. Mark, you're on with Frank Colucci. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead. Yeah.
My feeling is that if we went back to the old rule of 60 votes, that would require a more centrist kind of justice and would quell a lot of the problems that we're having now. What do you think about that?
Yeah, Frank, remind us about why the requirements were back to a simple majority. What happened there?
Okay. Well, as with most things, the real motivating factor, it kind of depends who you ask, right? There were issues, certainly, not just on the Supreme Court, but you have to look beyond the Supreme Court to lower federal courts. And during the second Bush administration, Democrats were beginning to block lower court Bush nominees to, say, courts of appeals. So there was a change for judicial nominations from nominations to go down from 60 votes to 50 and to make some compromises to get some through, to allow some nominations to proceed and others to be defeated. Basically on these political grounds. Then a few years later, during the Obama administration, when Republicans were beginning to block lower court nominees, the Democratic majority leader then, Harry Reid, eliminated the filibuster for all lower federal court nominations but kept it for the Supreme Court. Huh. Once you do that, is there a principled reason to keep it for the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
And that's what McConnell and the Republicans did in 2017 for Gorsuch, that they removed the filibuster completely for Supreme Court nominations, as it had already been removed for lower court nominations. Now, what would be the effect right now of restoring the 60-vote filibuster and a 60-vote, if not approval, at least allowance for a full vote on a Supreme Court nominee? In theory, that would be that might have the effect that the caller talks about, maybe cooling down things that a candidate could only get through if they had broad political support. On the other hand, however, it's very unlikely that either party is going to get to 60 votes now or in the future. So the practical effect of restoring the filibuster may well be a party that decides, just as McConnell and the Republicans did in 2016, they said no hearing for Gorsuch until the next election. Couldn't a party in have a unified idea that, you know what, we're a minority in the Senate, president of another party. If we can block all nominations with 41 votes, why shouldn't we do that? And so what you might affect is not a broad nominee. One other foreseeable consequence is you'll get no one confirmed to any federal court.
Again, the future of the U.S. Supreme Court's our topic. Dave in Kansas City, Frank, tweeted us this question. Do you think Chief Justice Roberts is likely to become more of a swing vote now that Kavanaugh is on the court?
I think the answer to that is yes, for two reasons. The main reason may not be ideological as much as institutional, because Roberts is not just a justice, he's a chief justice.
He has a different set of priorities.
Right,
perhaps.
And he has a larger, I think, institutional set of priorities that he has to consider, that the Supreme Court's not just a legal branch, but also relies essentially on political acceptance of its decisions. And maybe we can see in a couple of cases where Roberts maybe has moderated his stance a little bit. The most famous may well be in 2012 when Roberts, of all people, cast the deciding vote upholding the core constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
And even just this last term, Roberts actually joined the four liberal justices to say that under the Fourth Amendment, law enforcement actually has to get a warrant to acquire your cell phone location records, which the cell phone company owns,
right,
based on which tower that you ping on in the Carpenter versus U.S. case. So there are some cases where Roberts may seek to moderate things a little bit, and it may well be not merely from ideology, but from this larger institutional development, larger institutional concern.
Ultimately, Frank, do you think that Kavanaugh's rocky confirmation process is going to make it harder for him to succeed on the court?
I mean, as within the court, I don't foresee that, because we've seen the court as a whole, even the Democratic appointees, have come together. They mm-hmm. all attended the ceremony for Kavanaugh Saturday night and Sunday at the court and Monday at the court and his swearing in. They're actually familiar with him because Kavanaugh was a clerk for Justice Kennedy. This is actually the first time, one, that a justice has been replaced by his own clerk, and two, that a former justice has two clerks on the Supreme Court, because Gorsuch was a Kennedy clerk as well.
Wow.
So Kavanaugh in some ways is part of the Supreme Court family. And he knows how the institution works, and maybe he also knows the limits of how that institution works as well.
I'm going to grab one more question here. I'm just going to read it from Linda from on the Missouri side. How do we check for dementia in aging justices? I've got like 25 seconds.
And the answer is we don't, right? That is one issue that Fix the Court has with life tenure. There have been situations of justices who have been on the court even past cognitive decline, maybe just despite a president to not allow the nomination. Judge William Douglas in the 1970s didn't want Nixon to replace him, so he stayed on the court.
Frank Colucci again speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Frank, what a pleasure. Thanks very much for coming in today.
You
bet.
Great to talk to you.
Tomorrow, our first of two live broadcasts from NPR in Washington. We'll sit down with Senator Roy Blunt and NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. You won't want to miss it. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.